Alrighty, well, that was a long, long musical interlude there, folks. I had some great friends drop by the studio this afternoon here. Bill Patchett is here in the studio, and we're all very excited to see Bill, because we haven't seen much of Bill lately. And Rob Washburn is here for our weekly installment of Consider This Live. We're going to start this a little early this afternoon. We're going to do this, then we're going to go to the news. We're going to come back with our other guests this afternoon. Just a full slate of people here today. Rob, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks so much, Dave.
And joining us as well, Bill Patchett, as I said, but Rhonda Cunningham is here as well. And they are here because we're going to talk about the Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation. And we're going to be talking about, what was it again, sorry?
Equipped to care.
Equipped to care, exactly. And I think that's more than just a slogan, isn't it, folks?
Yes.
Well, so why don't we let the listeners in on what exactly equipped to care means?
Sure, I don't mind taking this one, Bill. As many of you may not realize, the responsibility for raising funds in the hospital setting has fallen to the community in the past 15 years. It's a significant responsibility that our foundation has undertaken, and that's raising the funds required to make sure that our equipment stays up to date and that we're able to offer our patients the very best healthcare experience possible. And because we moved in 13 years ago, a lot of the equipment that was new at that time is becoming obsolete. It's needing to be replaced. And when the hospital took a five-year look at what their capital requirements were going to be, mm-hmm. the number that they shared with us was close to $23 million.
Wow.
That is a significant amount of money to be raised in a county of this size. So our foundation board of directors, we take our role quite seriously, and we went into a strategic planning session, and we, of that $23 million, we feel that we can raise $12 million of that through our various fundraising initiatives. And the most recent one that we've launched is called the Equip to Care Program, and it's to raise funds specifically for diagnostic imaging equipment.
Wow. So you put a budget out there, $23 million, and that's quite a... But to put that in perspective for the listeners out there, that's almost as much money as raised by this community when we wanted to build the hospital in the first place, right?
Actually, it's significantly more. When we built the new hospital, we raised $15.6 million. So here we are 13 years later, and the number is now $23 million. And we recognize that there is a capacity that this community has. And so it's trying to find out, well, what is that number that requires the foundation to stand on its tippy toes and try a little harder than mm-hmm. what we've been successful at in the past couple of years, but also recognizing that it's a very competitive marketplace and that there's no shortage of worthwhile organizations that community people can support.
Well, and to that point, I mean, we had Linda Kay in here just recently, Rob, and, mm-hmm. and talking about fundraising for United Way. And, you know, the overwhelming message that was coming up from that discussion was the fact that, there, you know, we're it's like an aquifer. We're the well's almost dry here. So how do you convince people that, you know, one cause is more worthwhile than another?
Mm-hmm. I don't agree that the well is almost dry. I think that we're experiencing phenomenal support from this county, and we're having one of our best years ever. Last year, for our fiscal year ended March 31st, we raised over $4 million. And of that $4 million, we did enjoy a $2 million donation from a local citizen. This year, we've 5 months into our fiscal period, we've raised over $1 million. I think that our job as a charitable organization is to inspire people and to invite their support in a very meaningful way. And I think people are really able to align great healthcare with their charitable budget.
Well, maybe Bill would answer this one. I mean, you go out and you actually knock on doors and shake hands, very similar to what Rhonda does. What's your experience out there as you're talking to people, and what sort of success are you meeting with?
Well, I've just recently, in the last few months, I've visited 43 people, and out of the 43, I've only had one decline so far, and I've asked them from anywhere from $500 to $100,000, and it's been very successful. I also agree with Rhonda that when she says the well isn't dry. There's a lot of money out there. The people of Northumberland County realize now, I believe, or they're starting to realize quickly that it's their hospital. They own it. You and I own it. Mm-hmm. The hospital doesn't own it. And if they want to ensure that they have the equipment to look after them in future years, they're now starting to contribute towards it because it's very important. And you got to remember that our citizens, I think we're the seniors, we're at about 52% now, which puts a lot of pressure on the hospital as well. For the hospital itself, the Liberal government's starting to give them a little money, not enough in my opinion, but Lou's been very good. But as far as the individual fundraising, the goal that we set, I don't see it as being a challenge. I think definitely that we'll reach it. Just from the vibes I'm getting from people out there, we have a super team put together for the fundraising now. And we also, and I like to get this message through too, everywhere from the CEO to the custodian, the doctors, the lawyers, the specialists are doing a fantastic job. And as you know, I just experienced that for the last 2 years, and I got to tell you, I'm very fortunate because it costs the hospital a lot of money to look after me, plus the extra that my insurance looked after. So I'm pleased, and I'm happy to be here with you and Dave. It's just wonderful that we're getting this opportunity to let people know how important the hospital is, and it is important.
Now, the hospital raises money under different programs for different things. And I know that in the past you've gone out and raised money for other types of equipment. Could you just get it really clear for us? You said diagnostic imaging equipment, but at this point, you know, what about beds? What about, you know, everything, I'm sure, from tables to chairs to, I mean, how does all this fit together? Can you maybe get it a little clearer for our audience to understand?
Sure. So the foundation's mandate is to raise funds for medical equipment. And we raise funds in a whole variety of ways. A lot of times people think the only thing we do is organize special events. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we probably have three or four events that we organize exclusively with our own volunteers. And then there are other events that happen in the community where simply the proceeds are donated to the foundation. So from time to time, the capital requirements become quite significant, which mm-hmm. is the case. Our diagnostic imaging equipment, which is very expensive equipment. And when I use the term diagnostic imaging, I'm referring to CT scanner, yep. MRI, X-ray units, what have you. Mm-hmm. So we have developed this special program just to look at those priority needs. Over and above that, all of our other programs that we operate help fund the ongoing day-to-day equipment that the community requires. The beds, the IV pumps that you suggested.
Okay, good.
Well, you know what, on that note, and I hate to do this to the listeners, but you're going to have to hear more of the rest of this conversation after our break for the news. We're going to take our quick break for the news. When we come back, more of our conversation with Rhonda Cunningham and, of course, Bill Padgett. You're listening to Canada's only holistic political chat. This is The Drive Time. I'm Dave Glover. As I say, we will be right back.
Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Alrighty, yeah. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My guests in the studio are Bill Padgett and Rhonda Cunningham from the Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation. And just before the news break there, we were talking about sustainable equipment, the fact that stuff's already 10 years old, and you've been buying new equipment as it runs out. Rob, I know you had a question.
Yeah, I did. So we were talking before about the different fundraising programs. And we were talking about doing this huge amount in the face of all the other fundraising that goes on around. What sort of creative ways do you come at this in order to be able to sustain and to raise these sums of money?
I'll begin with the answer for that one. First of all, it's easy, Rob. As you know, all one has to do is ask, you receive. If you don't, you won't. I also am a strong believer that we have many fundraisings going out there in our community, but it doesn't make any difference because if people want to give to the hospital, they'll give to the hospital. People want to give to United Way, they'll give United Way. We all pick our favorites out, and that's the one we choose to make a donation to. So as far as a problem with all the others, no, I don't see that. And I see us being very successful in the next couple of years in bringing the money that's in necessary because people more and more every day are beginning to understand why it's so important that we have this equipment, especially the new developments over here. The potential is huge. These people, young people and senior people are moving in. They don't quite understand, but it won't take them long to realize and then support us.
Would you like to add to that, Rhonda?
Sure. I think one of the greatest opportunities we have as an organization is to try and engage the interest and support of these new residents that Bill just referenced. We see on a daily basis all kinds of people who are relocating to Northumberland County who are coming here to establish residences, and one of the key amenities that they cite as a factor in their decision to come here is the fact that we have this beautiful state-of-the-art hospital. And unfortunately, they weren't part of our story back when we built the hospital in the early 2000s, but we see our job now is to make sure that they are given the opportunity to continue to nurture the hospital and to help us out with our equipment needs, because obviously it was a reason why they came here, but also because they're going to want the same excellent healthcare services that our current residents already enjoy.
One of the things that oftentimes gets a bit confusing is the difference between the hospital, what goes on at the hospital, and what goes on at the foundation. And I know that the foundation is for raising monies to sustain the hospital, but the hospital also has its own financial concerns, and that obviously they're going through their plan and trying to meet provincial requirements. What do you say to people who look at you and say, well, you know, come on, isn't this supposed to be a provincially funded thing? And you know, we're already fighting with them to just have enough money so that we can run the hospital properly.
And now
this is on top of it.
I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we as a foundation encounter. People don't understand that there is very little government support provided for medical equipment. When I started working for the foundation in 1995, we were basically the icing on the cake. Anything we raised at that time was the icing on the cake. Now, 21 years later, we are the cake. I mean, if we don't raise it, there isn't any money to be able to maintain and replace our equipment. And that's a very challenging message for people to hear and understand. I most recently presented at two different Probus clubs, and when I shared that less than 5% of government funding is provided for medical equipment, they were shocked to hear that.
So what you're saying then is that if we don't raise the money locally and we don't have a CT scanner or a MRI scanner, that we maybe end up having to go to Oshawa or to Peterborough or to Belleville or Kingston or Toronto to get these services. So we're actually hurting ourselves as much as anything. It's that critical.
It is a very critical role. And in answer to your previous question, I think it is, yes, the hospital has its funding challenges for sure on the operational side, but you can see they also have a serious challenge on the capital side. And it's the capital side that the foundation undertakes to help with.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago that you were... It used to be that you were the icing on the cake. Now you are the entire cake, icing included. What is it that people should be saying to their members of Parliament? That, I mean, obviously this is a problem. I mean, I know we're struggling. Every other community in this province is struggling in the same way. I mean, obviously this is not a sustainable funding model.
If I may, Dave, it's not going to change. It's going to get worse. You know, 10, 15 years from now, the money's not going to be available because the government's putting out a huge amount that's going to the hospital. And every year we're getting more and more seniors using the hospital. So I think one has to get used to the idea that if we don't look after ourselves, especially with the equipment, it's not going to happen.
Well, that's got to be a pretty bitter pill to swallow, though, for the people who are listening to you speak at those progress meetings who were like me, under the impression, that obviously wrong impression, that the province paid for these things. Is that something that we can motivate the provincial government to get on board with? Are there no political parties right now talking about this type of funding?
Actually, I don't think you will ever see the government take back that responsibility.
No.
It will be a shared responsibility between government and community. And I think the reason it's gotten so expensive, if I may, is because of the explosion of technology.
Mm-hmm.
It has radically transformed our abilities to diagnose and treat patients, and to be able to keep pace with those technological advances has become far more than the government alone.
But Rhonda, isn't it also a question of having our own health care in our community? I mean, it's not just, I mean, we can have expensive technology in Peterborough or in Toronto, but then how many people are being served by that? And then what are the waiting lists and what are the waiting times? And all those other factors start to seem to me to be play into that. Is that true? I mean, is it really about just having our own, or should we just be sort of shrugging and saying, okay, we can't afford this, let's all go to Peterborough? I mean, are these the kinds of questions that we should be asking ourselves, I guess, to answer Dave's question?
Well, I think that hospitals try to be all things to all people when it comes to serving their community.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe at some point there's going to have to be some tough decisions made in terms of we may have to consider going beyond our immediate borders to access
mm-hmm.
care, because
mm-hmm.
there is going to be a capacity issue and an ability to stay ahead of it. I think we've been extraordinarily successful in the county of Northumberland. And, you know, a perfect example of that is an interview that happened last week with Dr. Allison Tilley. She's our newest surgeon. And in the interview, she was asked, why did she choose to come to Northumberland County? And she said that the well-equipped hospital that she was going to be able to practice in was a key decision. And I take a lot of pride in that statement, because that is the role that this community
mm-hmm.
plays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want people to understand that it's more than just their health care. It's also the recruitment and retention of our medical people that, you know, having excellent equipment helps with that aspect as well.
Well, this is ultimately, though, what we're talking about here is two-tiered healthcare. I mean, communities that can afford to have these facilities can have these facilities. Communities that can't afford to have these facilities don't have these facilities. That's got to really, you know, hurt for a lot of people. And I know that, you know, you're working hard and the foundation is working hard. When this was dumped on you guys over the course of a few years, I mean, was there no way to push back? Was there no way to say to the provincial government, wait a second here, you can't just build an empty building and expect the citizens to be able to afford to raise money every single year for the operation or for the purchase of equipment beyond the operating budget?
Yeah,
I don't understand how the provincial government got away with this, to be quite frank with you. I'm shocked as hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that, you know, we felt that we wanted this excellent health care for
mm-hmm.
our community, and that our community also supported that initiative, and we, in collaboration, are in this together. Should there have been pushback? I think that our pushback, which is usually initiated at our national association levels,
mm-hmm.
Was not getting any traction at all. No interest at all. There was no appetite to change. So we basically rolled up our sleeves and dug in.
Wow. And so you weren't getting support from the general public either, or were they just completely in the dark? I mean, like I said, this is the first time I've heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know we've been raising money since the hospital was built.
We've been raising money. As a foundation, we are actually, we were established in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
So, and before that, there was always money that was being raised at the hospital, primarily because people have a need to express appreciation for care.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody has had a very positive experience with their health services, they want to express that appreciation, and most often they do it through a donation.
Right.
They want to be able to help other people in similar situations. So there's some of that involved as well.
I was just going to say, part of the problem is that all the governments depend on the Lynn to look after it, which they do. They have full autonomy over everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell the hospitals what to do, where to spend the money, et cetera. That takes the pressure off the governments, and they like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they can step back and let the Lynn take all the pressure for it, and they don't have to get involved. But I did want to say to you that why I'm so positive about the money coming is that 13 years ago, when we did our fundraising, the average across the American continent was $225. We brought in $450, thanks to the people throughout Northumberland County and their generosity. They're the ones that made it happen, and I can see that repeating itself once again
right.
to support our hospital. As I say, I'm not too worried about it. I think people, as I said earlier, are starting to realize how important the hospital is.
Mm-hmm.
They're also starting to learn that the money's not going to be there, and if they don't look after their equipment, they're not going to have it to use, you know, mm-hmm. 5-10 years down the road.
Absolutely. Well, that, we're going to wrap it up. You guys, is there any final message you want to have to put out there, Ron? I know you've got some events coming up this very shortly.
Yes, yeah. I just say this. If anyone out there in Northumberland County has an idea, suggestion, and they want to do a fundraiser for us, just get a hold of Rhonda, and we'll sit down with them and work them out as long as they run it and they do it through the hospital. I expect a lot of them are going to come forward with some ideas and suggestions. So if you do, just give us a call, and we'll meet up with you.
Well, there you go. And you can contact Rhonda directly at 905-377-7767. Or you can direct your inquiries to the mailing address, Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation, 1000 De Palma Drive, Coburg. That's K9A5W6. Or phone them at 905-372-6811, extension 3066. Coming back, we're going to be, we've got a new guest coming into the hot seat right after this break. We're going to be talking about the possibility of a guaranteed income in the province of Ontario. I'm Dave Glover. You are listening to Canada's only holistic political chat. We will be right back.
Do you want to know what the future holds for you? Psychic Spiritual Healing Center is now opened in Ajax, Ontario. Call them now at 647-866-1292 for an appointment and one free reading. Palmistry reveals your true love, faith, and family. Teacup reading, crystal ball, Reiki healing, aura cleansing, photo reading of others or your pets, full life cycle readings, month-to-month forecast, one full year. All readings will receive past, present, and future predictions. Now on half-price special with this ad. Also receive free energy stone or healing crystal. Book your Halloween parties now. Hostess will receive a free reading. First Nation natives, seniors, and U.S. citizens will receive further discount. 12 experienced psychics with 99% accuracy, 72-hour results, and problem solving. Call now at 647-866-1292. Lines are open 24/7.
In 1776, England lost her American colonies.
In 1964, the British took them back. Coming Thursday, October the 13th at the Capitol Theatre, The British Invasion is live on stage.
Jeff Scott and the Buddy Ray Vaughans pay tribute to the Stones, Herman's Hermits,
the Dave Clark Five, the Hollies, Petula Clark,
and of course,
the Beatles!
Thursday, October the 13th at the Capitol.
If you would like to hear your business broadcast across Northumberland County, advertise with us, Northumberland 89.7.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Stand.
Stand.
Stand. Stand. You've been
much too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong stand. There's a midget standing tall, and the giant beside him about to fall.
Sly and the Family Stone on Truly Local Radio, Northumberland 89.7. Joining me in the studio now, along with Rob Washburn, is Christina Nairn. It is Nairn, right?
Nairn, yeah.
Yes. And she is a nurse with the Halliburton Kawartha Pine Ridge District Health Unit. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Today we are talking about a guaranteed income, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's correct. A basic guaranteed income.
Now, we know the province is talking about pilot projects. There are a few places that have already been named. What do you have to tell the listeners today about?
Well, that's wide open. I can tell you that I think it's necessary. The health unit in the spring, the Board of Health passed the resolution to adopt a position statement on the basic income guarantee. And so we've researched it. We are amongst many health units and large medical organizations, as well as social organizations across the country, who have supported a basic income guarantee and supported especially the pilot of re-researching it. And I say re-researching it because they did have a pilot back in 1974 in Dauphin, Manitoba. Mm-hmm. So this is another opportunity to have a much more up-to-date look at the specifics behind a basic guaranteed income, what it would mean, how it would be delivered, and the results. We know why we think it's necessary, and since I have the floor, I'll say that the current system, I think, would be perceived in most communities as adequate. One would maybe have the idea that Ontario Works is enough, and some would often say that there's laziness attributed to social service programs, and I can absolutely refute that. It's not that that system is in any way adequate. To have an individual receive $700, it will be going up to $700 shortly, to have an individual receive $700 a month doesn't allow them in our community to afford rent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're hoping that that's going to help somebody come out of poverty by keeping them in poverty, we've seen that that's just not helping. It's not adequate.
Well, you know, you hold on, Rob, if you could, because I want to reference the study you mentioned, or you say re-study.
Mm-hmm.
The shocking part about that study, of course, was that it was done, and then it was put on the shelf for some 20, 25 years.
That's right, until 2011.
And nobody looked at it. Nobody thought about it. Nobody wanted to find out what results were there.
That's right.
Is it because government was afraid that it was going to be too good, that the news was going to be so good that people would just be like, why aren't we doing it?
Yeah, well, that's kind of what it showed me when they did pull it
out.
It was 1,800 boxes of data. And, of course, in 1974 to 1979, that was all paper data.
Mm-hmm.
So Evelyn Forget, who is an economic researcher, did go and pull that all out and go through it. My understanding of why it was stopped and didn't continue, and it was a number of factors. I'm not sure that fear was one of them, but what they have found is that it quickly helped us to go against the biggest myth, which is that if you give people enough money just to survive, and a basic income is literally just barely rent and food, mm-hmm. if you give people enough money to survive, well, thank goodness they won't work. And her study from those years of that pilot showed that, in fact, that was not the case. People want to work. People want to feel productive. People want to be living at an adequate income. And so it didn't make people lazy, as the myth would be. In fact, it increased education, academic rates and successes, because high school students stayed in school. They weren't as encouraged in 1974 to stop school to help supplement the family income. So it showed that education rates increased. It showed that the only individuals really, besides the teenagers, who were staying home were mothers with young children. And I liken that to now, where actually we have a maternity and paternity benefits that support that. So we work towards that all and have taken some really good steps to take care of that. So in a way, I think in that study, they found that mothers were creating a maternity leave at that point that was appropriate. So it didn't find that people stayed home. It found that hospitalization rates decreased, especially around accidents, domestic violence, and mental mm-hmm. health. And those are key factors. You had just had the Hospital Foundation in here. Those are key factors of expense for our economies. And my favorite piece about what's happening in Ontario now is that Hugh Siegel is leading the reporting and the advisory of this. Hugh Siegel is a conservative.
Yes, he is.
And so this is really supporting the economic sense behind a basic income for a whole host of reasons. It allows people to be at a level where they can then engage in society and engage in the workforce.
How do you respond to people who say that the government is sort of, they've taken the best parts of this anyway? We don't have to give a guaranteed income because we've done maternity benefits and we're doing so many other things as well. They're essentially cherry picking the really good parts of this process. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair analogy, or is that just not true?
I think there's some great things actually that have happened, especially for families. I think that we have seen some increases provincially and federally for families to try to decrease our child poverty rate. So I think there have been some very positive moves. One place that is still really my greatest concern is for the individual. And one program, so the basic guaranteed income, isn't going to cut out all the programs. The basic guaranteed income right now is a supplement to ensure that you're at a level just over the poverty line. This mm-hmm. isn't vacations and good times.
How much money is that, Anne? How much money is that approximately?
Well, it depends on if you're an individual or a family and where you live. So you're looking at it at about a rate, what they've talked about, in around $30,000 to be able to bring yourself above the poverty rate. Mm. But that will be determined in the study of what's appropriate and where they are studying. So they will look at that in terms of setting that minimum. But it isn't a walk in a park. It's the ability to have somebody housed. And we know from a housing first perspective and what we'll be actually assessing in the 20,000 homes campaign for Northumberland soon, we know that it's critical to have people housed and be able to have food to be able to then move forward in a way that is only fair to them and to the rest of the community. So there's a lot of gains in bringing people up to just that piece and then allowing them to go forward.
Right.
So it's my understanding, though, that 70% of the people who live below the poverty line are, in fact, people who have jobs already.
Yes, that's
I wonder
true.
If you could just talk a little bit about that, because that's very shocking when I read mm-hmm. that.
I think that people aren't aware that if you're making minimum wage, that you are still not above the poverty line. So that's and where we're seeing the greatest gains in our job force and is in retail and the service sector. So we are seeing maybe we'll see job increases, but it's in lower paying jobs and precarious jobs. So if you're employed, it may not be that you're employed at a full time. Mm-hmm. You certainly might not have benefits or vacation or sick pay, and you're working, and often people are working more than one job.
So this is the part that sort of is a big question for me, is isn't this kind of a system really then supporting corporations to create precarious jobs rather than creating full-time jobs with benefits? Because now through our taxes, and we know that not all corporations pay their fair share of taxes, we're going to end up supporting each other. Well, meanwhile, corporations are bringing in huge profits because they have a workforce that they can hire at a precarious level.
And they're paying less taxes
And they're paying less taxes as well, exactly.
Yeah, precisely. So one of the pieces is that this is a component. So basic guaranteed income is only a component of increasing individuals' health and wellness and mm-hmm. a community's vitality. So it's only a piece. Still needs the other components to it around affordable housing and improved labor laws and employment standards, which are under review right now. So it's a component. One thing that I did hear stated last week, actually, was that one would wonder, and this will be something to continue to be studied, one would wonder if individuals do have better choice in their ability to be employed and where they may be employed. Does that help to put a bit of pressure on those sectors as well? So it's hoping that that will have a factor, but I really truly believe as well that the labor laws and standards have to address precarity and the lack of benefits and stability.
Is the province bringing up in enough revenue right now? I mean, we just had a Bill and Rhonda in here talking about the Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation, how the foundation essentially is what keeps that hospital's lights on mm-hmm. and keeps the machines that go ping going ping. Is it fair to say that provincial governments are going to balk at this because they don't have the revenue? Is it fair to say they're not? Because, you know, we talked about it. We talked about the fact that corporations will now essentially be able to pay even less mm-hmm. because of this guaranteed income, even though they're not paying as much as they were. Even in 1974, I mean, the median tax rate for corporations in 1974 was something like 47%. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now it's down to like 13. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they're paying a third of what they were paying back then. And back then, this was something that was, you know, relatively financeable. Mm-hmm. At this point, how is that going to be possible?
Well, and I agree with you. And I think one of the difficulties in a government taking this on is that some of these impacts are going to be long term, and that's not great politics for any party that comes in. That we're saying that you're going to see definite improvements in healthcare costs, definite improvements in crime and improvements socially that will benefit the community. Economically, this makes sense, but some of those economics are longer term, and that's a difficult grab, I would think, for any government that's looking in 4-year terms.
One of the things you mentioned early on was that you could make a very substantial argument that this works. And yet, surveys are showing 2/3 of Canadians are not willing to pay more taxes in order to support a program like this. 63% believe that it actually discourages work, and 53% say that it's going to be way too expensive. Mm-hmm. How do you bring about that sort of cultural shift that we're going to need to see in order to go forward with this kind of policy?
Well, one of the tricky pieces is that poverty is attitudes and beliefs and values. So how we judge that and how we see mm-hmm. it is based often on misinformation. It's based on old ideology, and it does take a cultural shift. What I like about the pilot is that people then can see the facts. No, this actually isn't going to cost more. What's really misunderstood right now as well is that our current social system isn't actually working.
No, it isn't.
Right? So if it's not actually working, we have to show people that. I can give the numbers and the pieces, but it's the people that I meet that help me to see how it's not working for mm-hmm. them.
And just so that we're clear, what's going to happen to all those programs like the disability program, like Ontario Works, like the gains for the seniors and OAS for mm-hmm. seniors? Yeah. What's going to happen to all of those?
It's interesting that you mentioned some of the programs for the seniors, because in some ways that's showing us that this type of guaranteed supplement can actually work. Mm-hmm. Seniors that are 65 and up are better off than seniors that are 60 to 65. So we're seeing decreased poverty rates for the ones that have the guaranteed income. We're seeing better food security for seniors. So it's actually an example of how this can work, just changing the age range of mm-hmm. it.
But what about those programs? Are they going to mm-hmm. still exist, or are we going to see all of those get phased out and then we're just going to have one program that will look after everybody, whether you're disabled or unemployed or just working in poverty, precarious labor, et cetera?
Right, yeah. I think what I've noted right recently within all the information is that it's looking at not all of those programs are going. Mm-hmm. Some of these programs will still stay. Some of the programs for families will still stay. But this is looking at replacing the more basic income programs. So the OW and the ODSP probably would be the more likely in there. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Siegel's report was supposed to be out in September, but that's going to be some excellent information to give us a picture for, 2016 rather than 1974.
So last question before you go. Why is the health unit? I would have expected some poverty activist group to be coming and talking to us about this. I was expecting maybe social services from the county come and talk to us. Why is a nurse sitting across from us right now and talking to us about this?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Income, although it's not always well understood or believed, income is actually the key determinant to your health. That's why I'm here. Income is the biggest determinant of how healthy you will be, how long you will live.
And that's obvious every time we go to the dollar sale at the local grocery store. I mean, everything that's on sale, chock full of salt, chock full of sugar, chock full of preservatives, chock full of everything that is probably not good for you. And yet, if you are in that low income bracket, that's all you can afford, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, we know this is a need. We know it's urgent because we've seen just the explosion of food banks since 1980, mm-hmm. which were supposed to be a stopgap. It was supposed to be a temporary thing.
Yeah.
6 months, we'll do food banks. Mm-hmm. And then it seems to me that once the government becomes comfortable with the fact that they don't have to provide something anymore, they're more than happy to just walk away from the table. And when it comes to income inequality, mm-hmm. even when it comes to the hospital, I think that's the tie-in from our previous conversation. I mean, the fact that the province is able to just walk away without anyone even really noticing, that to me is probably one of the greatest sins.
Well, I think the most interesting thing about all of this, maybe this is coming from left field, but Andrew Coyne wrote a recent column in the National Post supporting guaranteed income.
I'm
we have
shocked.
A progressive conservative who mm-hmm. is leading this initiative that's saying this is a good idea. When those kinds of people are getting on board, you have to start to say to yourself, is this really a left-wing progressive conspiracy? I don't think so. I think there's a lot of people saying, and I know recently Switzerland just turned this down, but Finland and I think Norway are also looking at it, and mm-hmm. Alberta. Mm-hmm. And
Quebec
are also looking at mm-hmm. it. So I think it's an idea that's time has come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the governments are taking way less money than they used to. And that I think they're more than happy to walk away from the table. And I think that's really a really huge part. That's why you're seeing conservatives or so-called conservatives, people on the right, talking about how this is not an unacceptable thing anymore, talking about how it's almost essential.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. The time has come. And for those that need the facts, that aren't out there just talking to people, then we're going to give them the facts. This is going to show the facts. And it is economically, it makes sense. And socially, it makes sense. And it allows people to engage in their communities much more meaningfully and with much more purpose, especially with the costs of housing and food mm-hmm. that are really just growing and astronomical. The challenges are just too great. So this is very timely, and I look forward to the results that come from the research so that we can come back and say, see, we were right.
Mm-hmm. We were right. My guest has been Christina Nair, and she is with the Kawartha Pine Ridge District. No, it's Halliburton, Kawartha Pine Ridge District Health Unit. Mm-hmm. She is also a nurse, and Rob Washburn and I will be back after this break, but Christina's got to go. Thank you very much for coming
Thank
by.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time. I'm Dave Glover. You're listening to The Drive Time. We'll be back after this break.
I'm standing here with Miss Jan Sprague. Jan Sprague from the Jan Sprague Show. here on Northumberland 89.7.
Jan, 2 years in the running, how has this experience changed you?
It's been fantastic. Honestly, Jim, it has been such an honor to get to know the people here in Northumberland, not only as listeners, but also the movers and shakers, and making sure that my listeners know what's happening here in Northumberland. Every Thursday afternoon, Thursdays at 12 noon, you can catch me here on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.
Come on out to Hometown Bingo. Monday through Wednesday, sessions are 12:30 and 7 p.m. Sessions for Thursday and Friday, 12:30, 7, and 9:45 p.m. Saturday and Sunday sessions, 12:30, 3:30, 7, and 9:45 p.m. Enjoy $2 per paper strip special Sunday through Wednesday and all day Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We are located at 884 Division Street. Give us a call at 905-372-5426 or visit us online at www.hometownbingo.ca. Our license number is 7884.
This is Allison Houston from Port Hope Public Library, your destination for inspiration, imagination, and information. There's great programming available at the Mary J. Benson branch of your public library starting in September. Introduce your little ones to the library Tuesday mornings at 11 a.m. with family story time. Library Book Club and Mystery Reader Book Club meet monthly to chat about books. Classic movie matinees happen every Tuesday afternoon. In September, we feature Greer Garson, Garbo, and Ginger Rogers, all legendary ladies of the silver screen. September sees the return of the Unfinished Stitchery Guild and Coronation Street Pings. Watch for library programs in October honoring Farley Mowat and celebrating Ontario Public Library Week. And you're invited to join the lively discussion every Wednesday at 2 p.m. at the Garden Hill branch. For details about programs and other library information, check out www.phpl.ca, call 905-885-4712, and find the library on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Want some spice with your bacon and eggs? Join me, John Holland, for the Saturday Morning Show, right here on Northumberland 89.7. I'll let you know what's going on throughout the county and bring back some memories playing some of the greatest hits of all time and some of your personal favorites. So let's grab a morning coffee together and make it a date. That's the Saturday Morning Show with me, John Holland, right here on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.
Northumberland 89.7 is powered by our volunteers. You can help us continue to be Northumberland's truly local radio station. Contact us by emailing info@northumberland897.ca.
And welcome back to The Drive Time. Rob Washburn still with me in the studio. Thanks to Christine and Nairn for coming here from the health unit, as well as Rhonda Cunningham and Bill Patchett coming here from the Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation to talk about how important that fundraising. You know what? I got to say right off the hop here, I had no idea that, I knew that the bulk of the equipment that was being purchased from the hospital was being done through the foundation and maintenance and stuff like that. But I had no idea really that the province is essentially just left that.
Walked the door.
They just walked away.
Yeah, no, they locked the door and walk away. They threw away the key. It's incredible when you think about it because, they've been, it's been slow. It's a dripping effect. You know, you see them, I've got raised for a sonar type machine or this equipment or that equipment. It was always small and something in addition to. Now we're talking about the basics and it's quite phenomenal. The other thing that I think I hope didn't get lost in that conversation, because we talked a lot about fundraising and tapping into the community. But what's absolutely critical about this is that if we don't want to be driving down the road to Peterborough, to Oshawa, to Bowmanville, to Belleville, to Kingston, to Toronto to get services, this is the fundraising campaign that makes the difference. Because it's the one that says, we've got an MRI machine, we've got a CAT scan machine, we've got X-ray machines, we've got heart monitors, we've got liver dialysis machines. This is the kind of stuff that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so critical in terms of the whole picture. I mean, it's not just the fact that, there was a story the other day in the newspaper that was saying they were over capacity. The beds were too full. They're slammed for space. I mean, that's a completely different issue. This is about whether or not you can go and just get simple things done. Mm-hmm. You know, surgery, a day surgery. Are we going to be going down the road because we can't afford the laser equipment to do somebody's cataracts?
Well, even for myself, I understand they now have a respirologist and respirology facilities at the hospital here locally. So I may be able to avoid traveling to Toronto Western Hospital to see my specialist. But it really got me because it you know, we talk about two-tiered health system. We talk about the legal case that's happening in British Columbia, yes, with that doctor in the clinic, and how Canada is slowly moving towards this pay for services type of health care. And, I mean, what really struck me was the point I made was, you know, communities that can't afford to do what we do are doing what you just said. They're driving down the highway. They're driving 2 and 3 hours. They're maybe having to spend hundreds of dollars per patient on ambulance rides to get them to and from their health facilities. I mean, I don't understand how in the 21st century, I mean, as Trudeau said, it's 2016 for crying out loud. Why is it that the provincial governments can walk away? And in to that point as well, I mean, Jane Philpott said yesterday that they want to be able to determine where any additional monies go from the federal government towards healthcare. I mean, just the basic provision of services seems to be in desperate want.
Buy the equipment. I mean, exactly. You know, but what another component to this, of course, would be to talk to people at the community care. I mean, I'd love to know how many drivers they have, how many hours they're spending on the road, what sort of distances they're covering, what sort of costs they're incurring for moving these patients around. I mean, you know, if we maybe spent less of that money and directed it more to equipment and services in our own community, maybe we wouldn't have to be sending people off down the road. I heard the other day that unfortunate accident near the Wesleyville on the other side of Port Hope was somebody going on their way to a community care visit in a hospital, down towards Oshawa, Bowmanville, something like that. I mean, you know, I agree with you. We've got to start to get a more holistic view of what's going on and really holding people accountable on what's taking place.
Well, one of the things I brought up to Christina as she was leaving was, you know, this idea of a guaranteed income sounds wonderful, and it sounds great if we can get away with it, but with the TPP, you know, hanging over our heads like a sword of Damocles, if this bill gets passed, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership gets ratified in this country, we're not going to be able to do anything like a guaranteed income supplement or a guaranteed minimum income in this province or this country, because our trading partners would consider it an unfair trading advantage. I mean, just like healthcare in Canada was considered an unfair trading advantage in NAFTA, and we have had to make certain, not restitutions necessarily, but certain changes to the way we provide our services so that it doesn't come across as an unfair trade advantage. I mean, just protecting Canadians, just protecting our health.
Well, and not to sound overly cynical or you know, like I'm a foil tin hat guy, but you know, to me, it's disturbing that as we were talking about, corporations are paying less and less and less in taxes. Mm-hmm. It's down to people like you and I, who are everyday kind of sorts. We, you know, pour all of our, you know, huge sums of our money into the tax system, mm-hmm. and now we want to do something that's going to help, and yet it's going to encourage precarious labor. Why should companies now hire full-time people? Because you know what? We can just put them all on precarious work, and they'll get this guaranteed income that we really don't have to pay for.
Nope.
The wealthy, the corporations, and you know, we'll let the middle and the lower classes sort of hash it out as to how they're going to distribute their monies. I think this is something that maybe should come directly from corporations and be paid for by them, and then maybe it would encourage them to start hiring people full-time, start paying benefits and doing it, because they may find it cheaper in the long run rather than all the rest of us having to come up with schemes like this.
Because ultimately, what are we talking about here? We're talking about subsidizing our own employment.
That's right.
And that's what Canadians need to wrap their heads around. I mean, when we give billions of dollars every year to the oil industry, for instance, or we give tax breaks to large mining productions, or even this new LNG Petronas deal. I mean, they're touting it as the largest private sector development in Canadian history. But, you know, if you parse through the financing, you realize just how much money is coming from everyday hardworking Canadians from across the entire country to subsidize the jobs that will be brought to help Petronas make even more money. I mean, it's we should all be shocked, listeners. I think we should all be shocked, and we should all be, you know, doing our due diligence to do our own research on some of the programs that are available, some of the programs that are being researched. You know, when the provincial government says, you know, we're looking at the possibility of expanding or at least researching a guaranteed minimum income, we need to look at the full picture, not just what the ultimate outcome is, but who is really going to benefit. Because I think you make a serious point there, Rob, about precarious labor.
The other thing, though, and this is the encouraging part about it, is we're seeing that the positive result of this. I mean, it's not a bad idea. And as Christina was talking about here, you know, there are not only short-term but long-term positive impacts on our community. So, I mean, it's not as if this is something that's half-baked or as she was saying, all these myths about, you know, a discouraging work or it takes any motivation.
Just helps the lazy be lazy.
That's all those kinds of urban myths go out the window, and we find out that, hey, this is something that really can work quite well.
Well, and we heard all of that during the Common Sense Revolution, 20, 30 years ago, when the conservatives were in power, talking about people on welfare spending all their money on beer. And we had a health minister that was telling people to go and negotiate at the grocery store for cans of tuna. I mean, the lack of real substantive knowledge to the day-to-day of people who are living in precarious situations, whether it be income or housing insecurities. I mean, it's almost as though, and I say this about John Tory when it comes to the TTC as well, because it's almost as though the people that want to have solutions for these problems have absolutely no idea what the base problem is. All they're seeing is either it's costing too much money and we need to take more money out of it, or the money's being wasted.
Dave, 7 out of 10 people who are living below poverty have a job. They have a job. It goes along with all those stats around food banks, where so many of the people that are going to food banks are people that are working.
Yep.
It's not people that are sitting around at home. They're out there. They're trying. It's just that the system's against them, or whatever set of circumstances they are facing, it doesn't work.
Is it real though, Rob? Because you know the Fraser Institute today came out with the notion that the middle class disparity. The Fraser Institute.
What do they know?
Out with a message today that the idea of wage and income disparity for the middle class is in fact a myth, and that Canadians middle class Canadians are actually making 52% more now than they were in 1976, and things are much cheaper now. This was their report today that it's a myth. And I got to tell you, I mean, from the people I know that are in the middle class and or struggling to become part of the middle class, the myth seems to be on the other shoe here or the other foot. Because from everything, I mean, the Fraser Institute said, you know, in 1976, you had to work X number of hours to buy a color TV. Now you only have to work a third of that many hours to buy a color TV. But, you know, now we got to consider the fact that the color TV you were purchasing in 1976 was probably made, union-made, right here in North America, and yet you can't get a quality union-made product in Canada if you want to buy a television. The other aspect, of course, is that televisions in 1976 were considered a luxury. Now, they pretty much give them away when you buy a home.
I have to wonder anything that comes out of the Fraser Institute, because their ideology drives a lot of their research. And I think they go in with a certain thing that they want to prove, and they'll make it sure it gets proven. I don't know. I shouldn't say that, because I'm sure the people who did the study were well-meaning and did the results are valid for with the context that they're in. But I think that context needs to be very, very carefully reviewed before we go believing that. I think, though, what we're talking about in terms of minimum incomes and this kind of thing in our community, I think rural Ontario, we face even greater hardships because we don't have the same level of investment that you see in larger urban centers where, you know, they have a mass that helps sustain programs and makes things more efficient and more things can be offered. I think, you know, we get a double whammy out here in rural Ontario, and I think that's why we have it so tough. I mean, that hospital, I mean, we basically bought it ourselves and paid for it ourselves, and we continue to do so. It's a real miracle how it all works. I mean, despite all the things that you can be critical of, and I know I'm oftentimes critical of what goes on up there, but it's quite amazing how it all comes together.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Well, especially given how much money has to come directly from donations from residents. I mean, that's the part that gets me every time. You know, they talk about how, I mean, we've just gotten additional funding of $600,000 a year, I think, which has been added to their budget, and that's going to be going forward. and it's still not enough money to maintain the operating budgets.
And
at the same time, we got to raise millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, to maintain the you know, whether it's a dialysis machine, whether it's an EKG machine or something else,
mm-hmm.
X-rays, all of that. And you know, part of that, of course, as Rhonda said, is because the technology keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that advances are being made every day, and, mm-hmm. and that's part of it. But I guess when it comes to that, my concern then becomes, well, how much money from taxpayers and from governments goes into research and development to make those new pieces of technology available,
mm-hmm.
and then we end up getting charged up the yin-yang.
Yeah, yeah.
Rob, I want to thank you for being here.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take you out, listeners. You've been listening to The Drive Time, Canada's only holistic political chat. I'm Dave Glover. I want to thank my guests again, Rhonda Cunningham. I want to thank Bill Patchett again. Always a pleasure to see him. And Christina Nairn. And I also want to thank Pete Fisher, who's been tweeting me throughout here, talking about what's happening in... Well, he's still very much interested in us talking to... the mayor of, is it Alan McMillan? Hector McMillan? Is it
Hector McMillan, yeah.
So he wants to talk about Hector. We might actually reach out and see if we can't get Hector to come on the radio and talk about what his situation is. But, I mean, I've already spoken to Pete about that myself. We're going to take you out with some heart. Because what are we talking about here mostly? We're talking about community. We're talking about embracing community. We're talking about love is what we're talking about. So here's Heart with What About Love on Truly Local Radio, Northumberland 89.7. I'll be back tomorrow, listeners.